The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, our affiliate stations, or CJSR.
Hello, people. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So I'm back from Dragon Con, home of the comic book commandos, the Firefly fanboys, and the young ladies devoted to the sensitive vampire theme. And for your information, I did not stalk Shatner while I was there, mainly because he was literally surrounded by fans the entire time. And at some point I did kind of a cost-benefit analysis of waiting in the lineup to see him. And then I went to buy Cthulhu stuff instead. And in addition to the other interesting things I learned at the con, I now know that dressing like a Wookiee does not make you a furry. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about right now, I suggest you just let it go. So the reason I actually went to Dragon Con in the first place was to attend the Skeptrack. It's run by Derek and Swoopy of the fantastic podcast Skepticality, and there were presentations by a veritable plethora of skeptics. Daniel Loxton, who I interviewed a few weeks ago, was there. So was Adam Savage, Phil Plate, Kylie Sturgis, Jeff Wagg, Eugenie Scott, Joe Nickel, Tim Farley, Rachel Dunlap, the entire crew of the Skeptics Guide to the Universe, a bunch of the Skeptics, and a ton more. Also present was the lovely Richard Saunders, paranormal investigator and host of the Skeptic Zone podcast, and he'll actually be the feature interview on today's show. He'll be talking about testing psychic and supernatural claims, how to become a credible resource for mainstream news, and how to keep a straight face even and especially when it's difficult. Let's start off the show with some speaking up. I have Michael Cruz on the line. Michael is a semi-retired theatrical lighting designer and has worked for 15 years and all across the country in Canadian theater. He retrained as a paramedic at the University of Iowa and now works as a primary care paramedic in York Region, just north of Toronto, Ontario. Michael is currently working towards a Bachelor of Science at Athabasca University and now blogs at theanxiousmedic.blogspot.com. Welcome, Michael.
Hello.
So you're here to talk about Darwin.
I am. The fantastic anniversary of Darwin's birth and his publication of On the Origin of Species. So this year, because of this whole kerfuffle over the anniversary, which we're so excited about, many groups have sprang up to celebrate the anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth 200 years ago and his subsequent publication of On the Origin of Species 50 years later. I became involved in organizing in my own very small way for a group called the Darwin 150 Project, found at darwin150.com. This group was started by a gentleman named Phil Terry as an outgrowth from another project, a nonprofit project called the Reading Odyssey, which is a classical book club of sorts that pairs a group of readers with an expert in several discussions about classical literature, including or using an actual telephone of all things. I believe Skype is included in that. The Darwin Project was launched on Facebook, and its first action was to see if we could get 200,000 members to support Darwin's 200th birthday. Well, they did it. The group started only 2 weeks before Darwin's birthday and managed to achieve its goal handsomely. And on February 12th, it culminated with a conference call by evolutionary types talking about their own corner of evolution, which is quite incredible. The call included such luminaries as John Rennie, the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, and George Amato, Dr. George Amato from the American Museum of Natural History. The group was much more successful than Phil and the gang had hoped, really, especially for a ragtag group of largely lay people. So they decided to build on this excitement and shoot for 1 million members by the anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species on November 24th, 2009. As well, the group expanded its mission to include a broader goal of public science education and, as such, has set up a lecture series on evolution, which is very exciting, and a reading group that will discuss On the Origin in conference calls throughout the fall, and that's through the Reading Odyssey. And the best part about this entire thing, Desiree, is it is free. We have several preeminent scholars presenting these live lectures: Everett Mendelssohn, Jonathan Weiner, Sean Carroll, and the great E.O. Wilson, among others. And we've just added a fifth celebratory lecture in the evening of the 24th of November, the actual anniversary of the publication of Darwin's great book. The lectures are free. They are available via webcast, by phone, by Skype, and you can actually attend them live as well. So they'll be accessible to people all over the world. Now, to register for any or all of the events, go to darwin150.com. And follow the links. The resources are large, but they're limited, so you have to register soon. And if you can't make it, don't worry. The lectures are being archived, so you can download them later. The first official lecture starts September the 16th, so coming up soon, and it's entitled The World Before Darwin by Professor Everett Mendelssohn, Professor Emeritus, Harvard University. And he'll give us a historical context of Darwin's world and set us up to really measure the impact that Darwin has had on modern biology in the next lectures. Each lecture is about an hour long, and as well, several universities are setting up classrooms where students can participate. So if you are a student or faculty, look around the biology departments and see if they are offering this this event. Now, what's really great about Darwin150.com and the Facebook group is that it is a grassroots organization that goes to show you that science education and science in general can be made accessible to the general public. And there's a large audience out there interested in learning more about science, which is just really invigorating. So tell your friends, make it a group event, and also check out the Reading Odyssey group, where the first group that you sign up for is free as well. And I've signed up for Homer's The Odyssey, and it starts in October. So go to Darwin150.com, and let's all celebrate this great scientist and show those creationists a thing or two about organizing.
Very nicely put. So you mentioned that some universities are setting up classrooms so that students can participate.
That's true.
Which is fantastic. I was also thinking that maybe secular and skeptical groups may want to host an event around the lecture.
That's a fantastic idea.
Maybe make it an on-topic night, perhaps combine it with a drinking skeptically event.
Alcohol would make the evening go really wonderfully, I think.
So what do you want people to do? You want people to join the Facebook group?
Join the Facebook group was the first, that was the first kind of project that we had, right? So that just shows, generates support in the Facebook community, certainly. But it also shows the wider public that it's okay to be, you know, to believe in evolution, right? That it's a widely held view of the world, and that it's that we want to support it and support the scientists working on it. But also, and this is the reason the Darwin150.com site was set up was as a catchment for the entire events that are going on around this thing. It's been sponsored by several really high-profile sponsors, including the New York Academy of Sciences, which is hosting the last lecture. So links to all the lectures, to all the Reading Odyssey reading groups, as well as the Facebook group will be all on that one page. So I would suggest going to Darwin150.com first and then getting involved that way. And it also has a great, on the page is a great kind of list of different scopes that you can get involved in if you only has 10 minutes or 5 minutes, or if you want to spend more time and delve deeper into the celebration. So it's a great opportunity there.
Lovely. Now, actually, you mentioned another Facebook group that you wanted to draw some attention to.
Yes, which is completely funny because a year ago I was deriding Facebook. I was completely against it. I'm not going to go on it. And somehow I've become hooked, and now I'm starting groups randomly in every different direction. I was down at TAM 7 this year.
Twitter is next. I'm sorry.
Twitter, yes. It's true. I know. I've become addicted to Twitter as well. It's terrible. I was down at TAM 7 this year, and I met up with a lovely woman from Santa Cruz, California, named Dana Bloom Rosen, who started a sort of a gay hookup meeting, that sounds terrible, a gay sort of a gay skeptics get together on the second day of TAM. And there were four of us lonely, people sort of at the table going, where's all the gay people here? Because we knew there were more. So we decided to start a Facebook group called Queerly Skeptical, just as a place for everyone to sort of build community and get together and talk about more rational kind of things in life. So if you go to Facebook and do a search for Queerly Skeptical, you'll find that group and you can join the conversation.
Perfect. Now, have you Is there going to be like a further goal with the Facebook group, or is it just a place to meet up?
You know, we don't know. It's important to sort of, I think, find out if the community exists first. I know there are people out there, but I'm not sure if people are interested in collecting, like meeting to discuss the gay perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Or to, if it's even necessary. So I think the Facebook group is a good start. I had, you know, I've been thinking about perhaps starting maybe another website that has a discussion group on it. Not everyone's on Facebook. Everyone likes Facebook, and so it'd be more accessible. But that certainly is, you know, more work than I care to think of right now. So we'll just start with this first. We'll see who's interested, and then we'll see if we can build a community and you know, try to include everybody in the sort of critical thinking movement.
And then you will come back to Skeptically Speaking and tell us about it.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here, Michael. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Desiree.
Have a good night.
Okay, you too. Take care.
And if you'd like to promote your own event or group, or you have a topic that you'd like to talk about, send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com and just put speaking up in the subject line, give us a brief rundown of what you'd like to talk about, and we'll contact you. And we'll be right back with Richard Saunders, paranormal investigator, skeptical podcaster, and all-around fascinating guy, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I am live with Richard Saunders. Now, Richard's been doing this being researching claims of the paranormal for over 10 years, and he's the co-host of the Skeptic Zone, Australia's fantastic science and reason podcast. He's been president, but is currently co-vice president of the Australian Skeptics, and in 2001, he received a life membership for his contributions to the organization. In 2008, he appeared as the resident skeptic judge on The One, an Australian reality television program that tested the alleged powers of several psychics. He's also a professional origamiist. And welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Richard.
I do all that stuff.
You do all that stuff. Good grief. So says your Wikipedia page.
Oh, thank goodness for that. I couldn't remember all that.
So which were you first, a paranormal researcher or a skeptic?
Good question. A skeptic, I think.
Well, were you always a difficult child? Always contrary and such?
I don't think so, but I was always fascinated by things.
Well, your father was a preacher.
Yeah.
Do you think that has any relevance here?
Actually, I don't. Some people ask me that from time to time, but I really don't think it had anything to do with it. I think I just found things curious regardless, and I grew up in the 70s where all this sort of thing was happening, from Uri Geller to the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot. It was a great time to be a kid.
Well, what kinds of supernatural happenings have you researched?
Well, lately it's been sort of things like ghosts, which I really love to research. I really like to go to supposed haunted places and creep about and see what happens. Also, more mundane things, I guess you'd say, like people who claim that they can talk with the dead, if you can call that mundane. Sitting down, having a reading, or letting them do their thing, and as I did on the TV show, calling it as I see it.
So now when we say research, what does that mean? Because when a lot of people think about paranormal research, they maybe think of things like EMF meters and infrared cameras, perhaps bringing along a psychic.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because research to me is knowing your material, knowing the background of it, but just basically being there on the scene and seeing what people can do or can't do with their claims. If someone says they claim to be able to tell your future or your fortune or your past, is going along and seeing what they can do.
Well, let's use ghosts then as an example here. So what would be the difference between the way you would research that and the way, you know, people like TV's Ghost Hunter would research that?
Well, you know, I haven't seen, being in Australia, I actually haven't seen this ghost hunting show. I've heard all about it. But I really must say, for those sort of people, their primary motivation is to produce an entertaining TV show. And everything else to that is completely secondary. If they can produce a show that's going to rate and people will want to watch, that's their aim. So they'll do what they have to do to do that sort of show. So, but for me to go out, for example, when I went out to investigate a haunted school, the most important thing I could do was not so much look at the background of the school and its history and where it's come from. It's to actually go there, wait, look, listen, observe, and see what happens on the spot at the time. Now, fortunately, when I did go to a haunted school, for example, I was able to sort of pick apart most of the claims. So in that respect, it wasn't really necessary for me to go into the history of the school. I was able to tell the teacher that this is happening because of this situation. This creaky floorboard is making this work. The light you see here is being reflected off this, that, and the other. So research is great. Research is all very well, but there's nothing like being on the scene for these things.
So you don't bring any equipment with you? You actually just use your powers of observation?
The last time I brought just a recording device and a camera. I don't bring fancy Geiger counters and meters and infrared zapping lights and things like that. It's generally really not necessary. But the recorder was good because I was able to set it down in a very haunted location, so-called, and then walk away and let it record by itself for half an hour, then come back and carefully listen. And all I got was background car noises and a fan going off and no ghosts.
No EVP.
Yeah, what can I say? I'll have to listen again more carefully.
That must be the problem.
That's it. It's me. It's all me.
So if you've been doing this for over 10 years, can you tell us about your least favorite case?
You know, I think the least favorite ones I do is when I go out to visit people who maybe are applicants for the Australian Skeptics $100,000 prize, which is very much like the James Randi $1 million prize. Mm-hmm. And they say, dear Mr. Saunders or dear Skeptics, I have the power to read people's toenails or whatever the case may be. It's amazing. I can do it blindfold and upside down in the bath. And I've got all these people swear that. And we say, oh, well, yeah, okay. We write to them and ask them to explain it a bit more. But sometimes we'll actually go out to visit them. And as usually is the case, we'll sit there and we'll say, well, okay, we're here now. We're open-minded. Please continue. And they just, nothing happens. They'll try to read us and they don't get anywhere. They get most things wrong. And it can be awkward and embarrassing because they really do think they have magical special powers.
Right.
But as soon as someone like myself or another skeptic goes along who sort of knows cold reading and knows what to look out for, of course, their powers disappear. But what's happening, of course, is that when they have their regular clients or people who go along to them, your average person off the street doesn't know the psychological techniques in cold reading, and so can be swept along with this and think that they're having a psychic experience. So it can be awkward and uncomfortable, but really when you go along and nothing happens and you say thank you very much and you give them a little gift to, you know, and say it was very brave of you to invite the skeptics out, not many people will do that. And you sort of drive away feeling a little bit sorry for them sometimes.
Oh, yeah, and that shows how compassionately you take this area.
So. Well, I know that most people that that we investigate or approach us are sincere. They right. really are. They're lovely, charming people. We go into their homes and have a cup of tea and have a nice chat and laugh, and then nothing happens. So yeah, it can be a little bit sad sometimes.
Audience, if you want to talk to Richard Saunders about ghosts and goblins and supernatural events, please do call in. It's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So any advice on people who would like to attend something like one of these ghost hunting trips, and maybe they are skeptics, what kind of advice would you give them?
Be polite. Don't think you know everything, and observe. Don't jump to any conclusions. Do all your thinking afterwards. A mistake would be go along and thinking you can explain everything and debunk everything on the spot, because there are no such things as ghosts, and that's really setting yourself up to look very foolish and very arrogant. Sometimes, as I said before, you get lucky and you can actually explain things on the spot, but it's better to keep cool, go away and think about what you've seen and learn from the experience yourself. It's frustrating. Sometimes you really want to go out there, especially to ghosts or a psychic, and stand up and say, "That's ridiculous. You're full of it. Yeah, this is not the way it works." But I found it much wiser to resist those temptations.
We had a question submitted on the website. Richard, what paranormal ability do you wish you had, and what would you use it for?
I wish I had the ability to see the past, because my memory's terrible. Actually, I wish I had the paranormal ability to remember faces and names. You know, I could meet somebody and a little projection would appear above their left shoulder saying, "This is Fred Nurge and he lives in here and you met him 3 years ago." That would be nice.
Is that a paranormal ability? Or is that...
That would be paranormal to me.
Oh, brilliant. Actually, what I'd like to hear about is the Australian skeptics. Can you tell us
yeah.
about them?
Australian skeptics kicked off in 1980, and it was actually James Randi who inspired people here to start a skeptical organization. And our founder is a fantastic man by the name of Dick Smith, very famous. Australian listeners will certainly know who Dick Smith is, who's been a strong supporter of science for many, many, many years. He's a self-made millionaire, and he puts his money to very good uses. He's widely loved and respected throughout Australia. So he kicked off Australian Skeptics together with some other people, and it's really in the last year and a half, 2 years, with the increase in things like podcasting, that skeptics everywhere, including Australia, have got a huge kick along, I think. And we're certainly noticing that here with our skeptics, and the pub is booming. We get a lot of listeners to the Skeptic Zone, which is very gratifying. So Australian skeptics have got outlets in every state, every capital, and our website is skeptics.com.au. So Australians and everybody can check that out.
And actually, I was going to mention the website. It's brilliant. You guys have a series of pamphlets. There's an amazing links page. And the news section shows just how busy you guys are.
Yeah. I just put up a new one about DragonCon, actually.
Well, and the magazine, The Skeptic, it's actually used by mainstream media looking for alternative viewpoints.
It is. Well, we send it out to mainstream media, and we certainly let people know when we've got something to say. So that magazine's been going for, I think since about 1981. It's one of the older skeptical journals in the world.
Now, audience, again, if you want to talk about the paranormal or what being a skeptic is like in Australia or how wonderfully organized they are, according to your website.
Is that the impression, is it? Thank
absolutely.
God for that.
Give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1, or you can email live@skepticallyspeaking.com. So, now, you send this out to reporters. Do you actually get reporters contacting you about these issues?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit random, though, because my number and the skeptics' number is in the index of many TV and radio people. And out of the blue, for some reason that we can't imagine, they'll call us and say, we need your comment about this, that, and the other. Sometimes it's not really our field. But I often end up getting my face on the morning television show or a radio interview. It's usually about psychics, I think, not so much about ghosts or monsters. Actually, UFOs, not so long ago, crop circles, that sort of thing. So it's good that the media here know that there is at least someone out there who they can contact.
So you guys actually have credibility. What's that
well, we
like?
We try. yes, we do. I hope we do. I hope we do. But remember, the media can be a bit of a tricky, the mainstream media, not you, of course, can be a bit tricky because they're primarily after a good story rather than what's the truth of this matter. And if sometimes the better story is that, man, maybe that was a UFO that buzzed the sheep and stole the cattle and had breakfast. That's the sort of line they'll pursue rather than, oh, it was just somebody who was drunk and they saw a light in the sky. So sometimes you can be treated well. Sometimes you walk away a little bit frustrated from the media. But it's okay by and large.
Well, that's just brilliant that they're contacting you. They know you exist.
They know we exist, yeah. Like UFOs, we exist in some form or another. Hey, listen, while I think about it, I must give a quick, really quick shout-out to Dr. Rachel Dunlop, who's listening to us in New York, and she's just about to run out of her hotel and head for Dewey's Flatiron, which is 210 Fifth Avenue, for Skeptics in the Pub in New York tonight. So, Rachie, good luck, and anybody who's in New York listening, as soon as the show's over, jump in a cab and head for Dewey's Flatiron to meet Dr. Rachie. And hello, too, to Kylie Sturgis listening in Perth, Australia.
Oh, that's lovely. They're taking up our bandwidth right now. You realize this is a community radio station.
Oh, okay.
Listen in a low-impact way, people. So, I'm wondering, okay, about... It seems like the Australian skeptics they're very widespread across Australia, but is it more of a resource building umbrella organization, or is it more of a lobby group?
Oh, that's a good question. I think our main purpose should be to lobby media and government, and lately we've been doing both, and we've had an enormous impact, and again, thanks to our good friend Dick Smith, who funded a campaign we were having, who funded an ad in a nationwide newspaper, which was not cheap. It was a big ad, and thanks largely to the very, very hard work and dedication of people like Dr. Rachel Dunlop, our campaign is to get parents, or to alert parents to the fact that people out there who call themselves pro-choice when it comes to vaccination are really anti-vaccination and are wrapped up in all sorts of completely wacky and loopy conspiracy theories, and convince parents, usually by scare tactics, not to vaccinate their children. So the pity is, this is the job of good government. Good government should be out there prosecuting these people or coming down on them or something.
Right.
They've been ignored by government and government agencies, which is a crime, I think. So it's left to people like us, the Australian skeptics, to not take direct action against these people because we can't. Mm-hmm. We're just a group. We're not the police or anything, but we can alert people. So that's where of course, due to people like Dr. Rachie and Dick Smith and the internet, getting people aware that these people are out there and having people independently voice their concern has made a big difference. And a lot of people now know that the group calling itself the Australian Vaccination Network is in fact vehemently anti-vaccination.
Right.
And is consumed by the most bizarre conspiracy theories, ranging from chemtrails to Illuminati to microchips to heaven knows what.
Well, so the anti-vaccination movement is quite strong in Australia then?
I don't think it's as strong as in North America. Mm. They've been around for a while. They've got a magazine. They give public talks. And by and large, they've gotten away with it for too long. Now, that we have a man here in the Skeptics by the name of Peter Bowditch, otherwise known as Ratbags, at ratbags.com, and he's been a tireless campaigner for many years against these people. But now, with the added help of other skeptics and the internet and people like Dick Smith, it really has turned the tide, I think. And these people, these anti-vaccination people, for the first time in their miserable existence, have had real opposition to their lunacy. So I hope it's making a difference.
So part of your initial strategy was to take out this newspaper ad.
Yeah, well, we've basically, it's just to let people know, because these anti-vaccination mob, they do public talks. They'll appear at this town hall or that town hall or whatever. And they're very clever. They'll usually say something like, well, this is going to be a debate about vaccination, or it's your right to choose. We invited all these other people from the other side, but they wouldn't appear. Well, of course they wouldn't appear. They know these people are loonies, mm-hmm. if nothing else. It's like a lot of scientists now won't appear with creationists. It just gives the creationists credibility, and it makes it look like there are two sides to a debate.
Exactly.
Which there are not. I mean, when it comes to vaccination, there are not two sides to this debate. So it's been an interesting time for us, because it's been something that we've got so into. And it's so gratifying when we do make a little bit of difference. And I really do feel that we are. And we're getting letters from people saying, I never knew these people existed to begin with, and I can't believe what they're saying. But the mainstream media so far haven't picked up on the fact that these people are really into wacky conspiracy theories, which I think they should.
So we just received actually an email from K.O. Myers of Grassroots Skeptics. He says, how can skepticism make the move from social community to social movement? And what's the best way for local groups to help drive that transition?
Yeah, big shout out to Grassroots Skeptics. I ran an ad for them on my show a week or two ago, I think. Yeah, they sent me a press release. Well done. Hey, they're making a great start already. I mean,
absolutely.
A press release. Fantastic. What a great idea. You send out press releases. Everybody's sending out press releases, but that doesn't mean you can't send out press releases. Well, I think we've had good success lately because we've had dedicated people with a passion who have been fed up with these problems, like the anti-vaccination group, and then they've just done the hard yards and the research to discover what they're all about, and they've let the world know, blogged about it, tweeted about it, podcast about it. So I think that's a huge step. We're all in a transition, and it really is being driven by the internet, and even the fact that I'm on your show right now being heard around the world is a huge part of it. We must also remember, too, that those we battle or those we oppose are also taking advantage of this new technology. But I think the skeptics are doing it very well. So I can't give you a clear course ahead. I think everyone's more or less doing the right thing. Just keep talking with each other. I'm finding Twitter an enormous resource, actually. It's if I have a question, I'll Twitter it, or if I need to alert people to something, I'll just send it out to Twitter. So that's probably the best advice I can give at the moment. I can't see the future. I think we're all doing more or less the right thing the way we're going.
So it seems like the Australian skeptics are quite organized, and maybe that is just something that it looks like from your website, but you guys seem like that you have sort of a measure of centralization there.
We have... every capital has a committee of Australian skeptics and Victorian skeptics, and there's Queensland and the other states too. But by and large, it's interesting. There seems to be a bit of a changing of the guard, because there are people been involved in skeptics in Australia for over 20 years, and suddenly we've got this new burst of younger people who are completely internet savvy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think that's making more difference in the last two or three years than many things that we've done before that in 15 years or whatever it was. The power, if you use correctly, the power and the reach of the internet is severely changing things, dramatically, I should say, changing things. So we're all along for the ride, I think.
So do you, what do you see as being the main difference between the Australian groups and the American groups? And I'll just leave out Canada, because quite honestly, we're just babies in the movement right now.
I think the main difference is that we like Vegemite and Mustix.
Really? Really? Mustix? Yeah. Back to the Mustix?
You know, absolutely. I mean, if the whole world ate Mustix and played cricket, they would, we'd be all fine. It would be great.
Richard, I have a problem with your Mustix. There was, this is what Richard was actually doing the entire time in Dragon Con, was running around shoving these, I don't even know what to call them. I believe George...
Ambrosia dipped in honey.
That's not the word Mustix. I would have used. There was actually a video with I think you offered them one to George Frabb.
He ate it.
Right, he did. He didn't quite know what to think about it, though. He was... What did he say it was... like solidified shaving cream.
Shaving cream, yes.
Like Barbasol. You made him flash back to his grandparents' bathroom. It was...
Oh, yes.
I don't know if that's fair.
But to get back to your question, I don't know if there's a big difference here. The internet's making everything an even playing field now. There was a big difference for many years because we're a little bit isolated down here in Australia, and we're communicating with post, then emails, and now it's instant everywhere. So I think it's a great leveler. And Canada's doing great. I mean, look what you're doing right now. That's fantastic. I don't have a live show like you do. I'm quite jealous.
Ooh, thank you. Good.
Yeah. I've got a soft spot for Canada because I used to live there. I'd like to come back and visit.
Now, you lived in Saskatchewan, actually.
I did, yeah.
Do you know how to spell it?
Yeah, give me a second. Where's my wiki?
You're cheating.
No, I don't know how to spell it, but I know how to say it.
People who live here don't know how to spell it.
I live in a little place called Tribune, so hello to Tribune.
If we have any listeners in Tribune, please do email in. And actually, for the rest of you, I realize no one's calling, and that's probably because you're scared, because for the last couple of weeks, when you call in, nobody can hear you. But I promise, if you call in... you will be able to hear Richard Saunders right now. You will be able to have an actual discussion. So the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. I'm not even going to let you email in. Call in, people.
I could call in myself and have a chat. That would be nice.
Could. That's. I'm assuming that's a syndrome of some kind. There's a name for that. So let's talk about your patron. Now, the Australian skeptics have a patron. I find this fascinating.
Well, that's the man Dick Smith, of course, who I was chatting about just a little while ago. He was a self-made millionaire. He started an electronics company with car radios way back in the, I guess it was the 70s, which did very well. He caught the boom of car radios and branched into more electronics and did... lots of publicity stunts, like created a fake iceberg and sailed it up Sydney Harbour just for publicity and did all sorts of things. He became so successful that he eventually sold his electronic chain of electronic stores. And then he did an amazing thing. He decided to use his money to have adventures. So he jumped in a helicopter. He taught himself how to fly a helicopter, or he took lessons, and he flew around the world. And he was the first man to fly around the world in a helicopter. Then he flew to the North Pole in a helicopter, and then to the South Pole. He's flown in a balloon across Australia. He flew in a balloon from New Zealand to Australia, and he just keeps having these amazing adventures, which is everyone's dream. He founded Australian Geographic, which became a very successful magazine. And then he founded Dick Smith Foods, which became a very successful line of foods. He's a terrific bloke, and we're very lucky to have him.
Was he a skeptic before? Did he hear about your financial plight,
he was subscribing to Skeptical Inquirer just in the very early 80s or the late 70s. And I'm not sure how he came to subscribe to that magazine. And it was due to that he found out about James Randi and was interested in water divining. And that's why he invited James Randi out and sort of kicked off the Australian skeptics. But we didn't approach him to fund this ad. He heard about what we were doing. He read about it in our magazine, and he approached us. And he said, In fact, he came to a meeting of ours at Skeptics in the Pub to give a talk, which we all appreciated. And we had a bit of a chat, and we told him about this campaign, and he was so impressed, and he thought it was such a good cause that a few days later he offered to fund the advertising in the newspaper. And it's just fantastic.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And I'd like to take this opportunity to say hello to any and all wealthy people listening to the show. I'd also like to remind you that CJSR's annual fundraising campaign begins on September 23rd, and that this station's equipment self-destructs on a regular basis. Remember those two things, and usually during this show. Just saying. I think what we'll do now is just go to a wee break, and we will be right back with more Australian skeptics and paranormal debunking and such with Richard Saunders.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be taking a look at how one guy is making a difference in the struggle to keep Hollywood celebrity opinions out of medical discussions. We'll be on the line with Derek Bartholomos, creator of the website The Jenny McCarthy Body Count. We'll be talking about anti-vaccination advocates, the recent rise in treatable illnesses, and why some people really hate science. Call in and question everything on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Richard Saunders, Australian skeptic, podcaster, origamiist, and all-around lovely person.
Aww.
And I believe we have a caller on the line. Go ahead, caller. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to ask if, Richard, do you think that the issues with Wu is due to a lack of education? I know that's not particularly your specialty, but it seems in the U.S. that we have a more obvious problem with Wu, but I don't know the situation in Australia. Could you enlighten me on this fact?
I think the question was, is the prevalence of Wu due to lack of education? Was that right?
Yes.
Very, very difficult to answer that question. People like and want and need to believe regardless. I think it's probably a good thing that they become more educated with the critical thinking programs and whatnot in school. But even though people are, and even though some people are very highly educated, people can still fall for the woo. It's hard to... For example, I don't think there'll ever be in school classes a course about cold reading and the techniques used by so-called psychics. And if you don't know how that works and you go along for a psychic reading, you can be completely blown away. And once you're convinced, or once you're really blown away and it's very personal, it's very difficult to unconvince yourself or to step back and take stock and see what's really going on. The Wu situation in Australia, I think it's more or less the same as is in the United States. We have more or less the same sort of thing. People who talk to the dead, people who cast horoscopes, water diviners. There's really not much difference at all.
Well, thanks
thank
very
you
much,
so much for answering my question. And thank you for coming to DragonCon this year. You're fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank
Bye.
You.
And I'm sorry, love, I didn't announce your name. That was Jennifer from Louisiana.
Jennifer! Right, of course.
So, now, obviously the media has been paying attention to Australian skeptics, so much so that you were offered up the coveted position of reality show judge. Because that's
yes.
when you know you've made it.
That's how I know I've made it. Oh boy, I'm in trouble now.
Can you tell us about the one?
The one was it's a reality show. I mean, there's nothing more fake than a reality show. It was sort of like a competition. Now, the producers said that they had seven of Australia's top psychics, which was very interesting to me because we've been looking for psychics for years and years and years and years. Nevertheless, they found seven people who they claim were Australia's top psychics. And I, together with a believing judge, Stacey DeMarco, who is also a witch, judged these people and commented on their so-called psychic ability. Now, from my point of view, what I saw mostly in the studio, in the audience situation, was simple, pure, straightforward, out-of-the-book cold reading, nothing special. And also when our contestants were set tasks in the field, which was sort of pre-recorded, they failed roughly 95 or 97 or 93, I can't remember the exact figure, percent of the time they failed. So to my point of view, nothing happened. But to the believer, it didn't make any difference, and they certainly got what they needed to get out of it. But I did learn an awful lot. I really did. I found it's fascinating when you're forced to go through this for week after week. A good thing that I learned was a wonderful no-lose situation for a psychic. Here's the setup. The psychic was asked to find something. And to make it short, I'll just say the psychic was asked to choose between two doors, and behind one door was the prize. So the psychic was up there, and this didn't happen, but it was sort of the thinking they were using. So the psychic got in front of the two doors and stood and concentrated for a while, then opened the door, but it was the booby prize. They lost.
Mm-hmm.
Now you would think, okay, well, your psychic abilities obviously weren't happening there at the moment. Nothing, you know, no psychic powers. But this is the reasoning, and this is why I appreciate the fact that I actually went through all this, because I did learn these little things. Their reasoning for failure was not that they're not psychic. Remember, that's the primary thing. They must preserve the fact that they're getting messages from spirits. They were getting messages from spirits, but the spirit was teaching them a lesson.
Oh my, really?
Don't get too cocky. I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to give you the wrong door. Now, look at that. What an elegant out it is. It preserves the belief that these people are in contact with spirits or ghosts or guides or angels or whatever the case may be. No matter what happens, they can still claim to be in contact with the spirit or the guide, which is the more important thing. I got the wrong door. That's because I was being taught a lesson by my spirits. Isn't that amazing? I got the right door because the spirits told me which way to go. Isn't that amazing? Brilliant. The win-win situation.
Now, honestly, how did you not burst out laughing?
Fingernails in the legs.
Good.
I think helped. Very long days in the studio.
I'd like to hear your coping strategies. Good.
Yeah.
Because honestly, for a skeptic in that situation, that must be very difficult.
Yeah, it was. It was difficult for me to keep up with when they were going in their full flight with reading. Some of them talked very quickly, and I was making notes as fast as I could, but it was very difficult to summarize that on the spot. So they'd do a reading for 15 minutes. The host would look at me and say, "Well, Richard, what do you think?" Now, to properly do it, I would have to listen to the reading slowly again, make careful notes, look at the path of the way the psychology worked. Then I could comment. But on the spot, it was almost impossible. So I just did the best that I could.
Now, audience, you heard the phone worked. Phone in 780-492-2577 extension 1, and you too can be on the radio. So you appearing on a show like the one, what does that accomplish for skeptics?
Well, it did raise our profile. It really did. Now, I was under no illusions when I did the show. I knew it would be more favorable to people claiming psychic power. That's why the show existed. If I didn't go on the show, they would have done it anyway, and they may have had a skeptical judge who didn't know his or her facts and didn't know the routines and the cold reading, and that would have been not very good for our point of view. But I think in the end, if it achieved anything for our side, it simply raised our profile, and a lot of people for the first time learned that there was a group called Australian Skeptics, and they could Google us and get in contact with us, which people did. So I'm very grateful that happened. For me personally, it meant that people would occasionally come up to me in the street and argue with me, or say I was mean, or send me rude letters. Or no, it wasn't that bad.
For sure, it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't that bad. Okay, I had a few people argue with me and say, how dare I be so negative and rude on the show, which I wasn't. You know, I took pains to be polite, full and funny and all the rest of it, but to the believer watching, I was simply the heretic, so no matter what I did. And some woman came up to me because one of our contestants was her personal psychic, the one she goes to all the time, and she was just completely at a loss to understand why someone like me, who seems to be reasonably articulate and intelligent, how I failed to see that this guy, her psychic, wasn't, you know, amazingly gifted and could see amazing things. And I said, well, look, I'm sorry, it's what I saw was simply pure cold reading, and we know how that's done. And she just, she didn't know what to say to me, so she left thinking I was either a liar or a complete fool.
Or a horrible individual, right? Who's just...
Or a horrible individual,
you have,
that's right.
Bad energy, Richard.
Yeah,
I've been told energy. The same thing.
So, a lot of people in the audience came up to me during the taping of the show when we had breaks and would say the same thing to me. You know, how could I not see that this person just did a psychic act or whatever it was? And someone came up to me and said you always know where they're coming from when they say, look, Mr. Skeptic, they'll call you Mr. Skeptic. They said, do you believe in energy? And I said, what do you mean by energy? And there was no answer. They didn't know what they meant by the word energy, because a lot of people don't know what the word means.
That's a very good point, and I'm going to use that.
Yeah, so what do you mean by energy? They'll come back with saying love energy, you know, the power of, oh, good grief, okay, yeah.
You're going to give me hives just talking about that. So you've been the skeptic on a reality show, but you also do a show of another kind, the Mystery Investigators.
Yes, with Dr. Rachie Dunlop, and in fact we did a short version of the show at Dragon Con, which we really enjoyed. I was, you know, people who were at Dragon Con who were speaking to me would have realized that I was a little bit under the weather. I had a bad throat and I was croaking a lot, but we got through it and we had a good time. We go to schools or we do science days at museums and things, and we do a show where we have a bed of nails and we do water divining, and the full show we demonstrate fire walking. It's a show aimed at upper primary, upper elementary to high school, right through to college. And I think that's what I really love to do from time to time, is that sort of stuff. I guess I'm a real ham bone at heart.
I was actually I attended your presentation and I thought it was brilliant. It showed children both that dousing is crap and how double blind studies work. It was
showed children that the claims of dousing haven't lived up to the promise so far.
Right, not
and it
crap.
Shows them how not that it's crap. Now
right,
we must.
Okay.
I know it's easier for us to then take a position and say this doesn't work. End of story. But what we do in the show is say, so far, it hasn't worked. And we really think it doesn't. Really say now it probably doesn't work. But we must always be ready to test it again, because you never know, we might be wrong.
And that's definitely the impression that you got across.
Yeah, yeah. Even though, I mean, between you and me and the thousands of listeners, I think it's crap. No, actually, right. No, we're always ready to test it again, really.
Yeah. So you actually give those presentations to schools.
Yes, yes. Schools or school groups who come to museums here in Sydney. We do the Australian Museum, the Natural History Museum has a science week every year. The national broadcaster here in Australia has a science week where we go to their building and do the demonstration, and schools and anybody who will have us. Mysteryinvestigators.com.
Brilliant. So do you think children are able to see kind of the natural extensions of this when they watch it? Like, for example, like, do you see any visible epiphanies in the audience?
Good question. Probably not, because they're a little too young, actually. But what we want to do is spark their curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really do that. And when we do the firewalking, one of the most important messages we get across, and when we say this during the demonstration, is that now, when you get older, there might be people who come to you and say that for a lot of money, you can learn how to do firewalking. Well, just remember that you've just done it here, and you know how it works. It's really just physics. It's like walking on hot sand on a beach on a hot day. So hopefully, I mean, we've been doing this show now for 4 or 5 or 6 years. Hopefully, some kids have actually been in the situation where someone says, oh, come to my motivational course, and at the end you can walk across a bed of coals. And I say, hang on a second, I remember this show when I was at school. I hope that's happened.
So, actually, we have another question submitted by Mark. I believe it's Iacelli here in Edmonton. I realize this is not a question specifically related to psychic and supernatural topics, but I wonder if Richard can provide his thoughts on why, as to why seemingly skeptical people lose their powers of reason on certain issues. I'm thinking about Bill Maher, an intelligent person who is skeptical about religion, but who has bought into all the anti-vaccine baloney.
I think in the end we're all human and we're all likely to do this. There must be something, and other people could probably tell you, I'm blind to it, where I put my brain on hold and I don't think critically about issues. I think everybody's like that. But why some people can be so dramatic, where they completely accept the scientific method in one line and completely reject it somewhere else, is not something I have any experience with personally, because I've never thought like that. I don't know. I think it's just part of being human. Some people are like that and some people aren't like that. I wish I could nail it down.
So you said this happens to everybody. So where's your instance of cognitive dissonance?
That's the word. Well, that's it, you see. It's not for me to know because I can't see it. So my friends will probably tell you. Maybe it's to do with mustiques. I don't know.
Kylie Sturgis, do call in now, 780-492-2577, extension 1.
Honestly, I don't know. Maybe it's dealing with people. Maybe it's if I'm rude or unthinking sometimes, which I am, which everybody is from time to time. You don't see it or you don't realize it, or you offend people sometimes, or you're... Honestly, I don't know. But I can tell you it doesn't fall within the scope of the what I deal with, which is claims of the paranormal and the supernatural.
Well, I think we have time for one last question, and it was submitted via the website, and it's quite cute. Dear Richard Saunders, I love your Australian accent. Listening to past Skeptically Speaking shows, I have noticed that Desiree uses an oddly endearing pronunciation of the word habitable. So I would like to hear how you pronounce the word habitable as an excuse to make her read it twice, and on the off chance that there may be a second person who says it like she does. Thank you.
Habitable?
Well, that's how I say it. How do you say it?
What is the word we're trying to say?
Other people pronounce it habitable.
Habitable. I see.
He's assuming it's a Commonwealth thing.
This planet is not habitable, Captain. Habitable. Yeah.
Okay, that's so it's just me. It's a speech impediment. Thank you. Fair listener, for bringing it up. Anyway.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Thank you, sir. And actually...
A boat. I wouldn't worry about it. Eh?
I don't say that. Do yes, I sound like that?
Yeah, sometimes.
And with that, thanks very much to Richard Saunders for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And please visit www.skepticzone.tv for my podcast.
And if you're not listening to it already, I don't understand why it's brilliant. So feel free to head over to skepticallyspeaking.com, our site actually, to comment on this lovely episode. Check out the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, so you can subscribe to this lovely podcast and make it automatic, so it just automatically downloads right into your iPod. It's lovely that way. And thanks to Mike and Jarrett for the on-air work, to Josh for post-production, and to Ryan for being the best intern ever. And we'll see everyone next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Sometimes fall up, but you never see, and everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. the hippies are working for the